So I'd like to see the youth come up because I have something to share with them that I think is kind of cool. And children, why don't you come up here? I got that special thing in my pocket and I want to show it to you and tell you about it. So since you'll never guess what I have in my pocket, how about I just show it to you? Or does someone want to try? Willem? It is something. Whoa. Well, maybe. Pretty close. Pretty close. Not a Hillary Clinton badge, no. That's on my fridge. Yeah? A small loan of $1 million. If someone gave me a gift for $1 million, I'd take it, but I don't know about a loan. Okay, so this is what I have. It is a very, very old harmonica. It's a harmonica, and it's not just any harmonica. This is a Hohner chromonica. That means that it has two, whatever musicians call these things. See? So it's got a lot of notes. But this harmonica is actually very special to me because my father received it as a gift from his father in 1937. So this is a really ancient harmonica, and it belonged to my father. Some people object to that being ancient. So, this harmonica is beat up. And the story that goes with it is that when the Germans made war on Holland, my dad, who was just a little boy, was so angry and upset that he picked it up and he threw it on the ground because this harmonica was made in Germany. And that's why it's all bent and broken. And nevertheless, he played it his whole life. Now, I'm going to be honest. My father was a very bad harmonica player. But he tried very hard. And especially when I think it was Neil Young started using a harmonica and my dad was still a young man, then he thought he was pretty cool because he had a harmonica too. He only knew one or two songs. One was the Dutch national anthem, which I guess was his way of getting back at the Nazis. So anyways, this is a very precious harmonica to me, and I'm going to give it in a few weeks at Christmas. I'm going to give it to my grandson, Taps, who's the same age now that my father was when he got his harmonica. And I was thinking about what I could say to Taps when I gave him this harmonica. And someone, well, I had an idea about what I was going to say, but someone this morning reminded me of something else that I think is even better, and this is what I'm going to say to Taps when I give him the harmonica. I'm going to say that when we make music, even if it isn't perfect music, but when we make music, we pray twice. Sometimes when we're disappointed or sad, we just need to share that, maybe with our parents, maybe with our friends, but we can also share it with God. And one of the best ways to share with God is to just make music, like we're going to do this morning when we do some Leonard Cohen, when we do some hymns, as we've already done. We're going to make music and we're going to say to God that even though it's been a rough week, we're still going to pray and share and be honest and try to be like Jesus. And that's what I wanted to say to you this morning. Thanks, Alistair. There were words in that anthem that fit with "Make me a channel of your peace." Just in case you didn't hear them, I am thy servant, and I have done these things according to thy word, a pledge to do the right thing. Friends, I don't want to be too melodramatic, but last Tuesday night when Donald Trump was elected, I was gobsmacked. Irene and I had some back and forth agonizing calls with our kids in the States. I went to bed stunned. I woke up depressed. I was unable to read any commentary about the American election for days afterwards. And at some level, I am afraid for what is next. I struggled to find the right words, we being Canadians, they being Americans, we being neighbors, this not being really our election. But I do think that it's so important what happens in the United States that sometimes we have to pay attention, not only as individuals for how it might affect us, but we have to pay attention as neighbors and as people who claim at least to share many of the ideals that mark the American Republic and its history. Now, personally, I don't like Donald Trump's trade or tax or foreign policies, and I worry about the Supreme Court picks that he might make over the next few years. Still, I also understand that among people of good repute, there can be disagreement about such policy matters. On the other hand, too many of Trump's policies and statements are not so much debatable as immoral. In spite of the science and the apocalyptic risk, he denies global climate change and has appointed a denier to head the EPA. His hatred of the other and of the stranger is xenophobic. It means he wants to ban all Muslim immigration to the United States. It means he wants to deport millions of non-documented immigrants. And he has no sympathy with the issues that led to the Black Lives Matter movement. His statements about preferring Jewish people to blacks as his employees, or denying that Obama was born in the United States or is a Christian. His mockery of people with disabilities, his pathetic and demeaning treatment of women, his goading of supporters to violence against protesters at his rallies, the actions like this are not just impolitic, a matter of us disagreeing about policy. They are immoral. Still, as the week wore on and I tried to understand, it dawned on me that I'm not the only one who's afraid. A sizable portion, now this is important, not all, but a key part of Trump's support base, they belong to a large American, mostly white underclass that also doesn't have much by way of prospects. And they are afraid too. I do not approve of this underclass's decision to support Trump, but I think we need to understand them and their grievances. Some of the lessons we learn might be relevant to us as neighbors and Christians. So who is this underclass I'm speaking about? They've actually received quite a bit of attention since the election. They're mostly white people who are afraid that the American dream is a fantasy as far as they and their families go. They can't keep up with the change. The change from a General Motors and U.S. Steel economy to a Microsoft and McDonald's economy. They lost their homes, or at least a lot of equity, perhaps had to move to the other end of the country in the financial crisis of 9 years ago. They can't afford college for their kids, or at least they don't think they can. They're stuck, some of them, in a generations-long spiral of poverty. And believing that they have nothing to lose, they chose Trump as their last best hope for somehow changing the game that they have kept on losing. I am afraid of Donald Trump for intellectual and moral reasons, but many of the people who voted for Trump are afraid for themselves. So this week, the New York Times ran an article entitled Six Books to Help Understand Trump's Win. Most of these books are about this white underclass and their gripes. I had already read one of them, published last year, with the title The Unwinding, An Inner History of the New America. It's a book about how white factory workers and tobacco farmers and backwoods people and even politicians have been left behind by the big changes that have taken place in the American economy and social landscape since the Second World War. So instead of taking advantage of this landscape, they have suffered from it. One of the chapters is about Newt Gingrich and how he discovered, as far as this white underclass is concerned, that facts don't matter anymore. Gingrich has suggested that politicians should offer up political venom, true or not, any time, and that when they do so, they will get away with it because facts don't matter anymore. A lesson that was not lost on Donald Trump. Gingrich, says the author, gave them mustard gas, and they used it on every conceivable enemy. Another of the books is Strangers in Their Own Land, which explains why many poor white Americans believe that others, mostly immigrants, blacks, Hispanics, women, others are cutting in line, and that the federal government is supporting these people on the dole, taking money from the workers and giving it to the idle. This is a book about the fear and loathing that white people have when they imagine even poorer, more marginalized people taking the jobs and benefits that they think they deserve. And then there's this book with this very disturbing title, White Trash, The 400-Year Untold History of Class in America. It tells how from America's earliest days, a white underclass has slowly grown in America's backwaters and suburbs. Their ancestors came over on the Mayflower as indentured servants, slaves, prisoners, and later yet as hated Irish or Hispanic Catholic immigrants. This underclass died for America in its wars, was always available as cheap labor for the mines and on the farms, but was largely ignored when it came to sharing most of the benefits of America's economic growth, at least from their perspective. A significant number of the people who voted for Trump experienced a generation or two of good-paying factory jobs, but now have to settle for $12 an hour at Walmart. They've been cut off from welfare by Bill Clinton's reforms. They think the system, free trade, banking, healthcare, immigration, the one percenters, are all stacked against them. They point to the brokers and the bankers and the CEOs who made out like bandits during the financial meltdown when they lost their homes. They resent the fact that Bush and son ran America, that Trudeau and son run Canada, that Clinton and his wife nearly did it again, and right or wrong, it suggests to them that the whole system is rigged to keep the powerful and successful in power, rigged to keep people like them down. And this underclass, and I want to stress, it's not a majority, it's not most of the people, they're a small but significant demographic. This underclass is full of dread for the future. And they don't give a damn what Trump says about women or blacks or Hispanics, people that they actually need to make common cause with but won't. They don't care whether he has gone bankrupt or fails to pay his contractors. They don't care whether Trump deals with Putin or gropes women or says he'll nuke the North Koreans. They just want someone who will finally, finally feel their pain and do something about it, never mind any other historically marginalized or ethnic group in the United States. So now what? Well, I have some friends who wrote on Facebook, "Don't worry, God is in control." To which I responded, "Why blame God or God's plan? We made this bed, we have to sleep in it. No need to bring God into it." She responded by defriending me. But essentially, this approach to God's plan and Trump as God's surprising crooked stick to make everything good again, this approach washes our hands of any responsibility to do something about his poison politics, either in the United States or similar poison politics when it arises, as it sometimes has here in Canada. In this case, faith in God adds up to an excuse to carry on as before, to baptize the status quo, especially if we're doing okay. This adds up to a weak, emasculated Christianity devoid of inspiration, direction, and wisdom. So I want to suggest a different approach, one that's less interested in putting God on a throne where God runs things than it is interested in inspiring Christians like us to be like Christ here and now, even when it comes to politics. "We should not fear as they fear," says Peter. We should be Christians. You see, I think the solution to Trumpism, at least in the long term, is not so much to fear Trump as it is to pay careful, empathetic, loving attention to the concerns of all of America's and Canada's marginalized classes of people, whether they think of themselves proudly sometimes as white trash, or whether they're another marginalized group. We ought to pay attention to all the marginalized, just as Jesus sought out lepers and women of ill repute and tax collectors for his inner circle. And in fact, the whole point of living in a democracy is that here, we, whether rich or poor, influential or not, we get to make decisions together for the common good and for our neighbor's good. We should make decisions rather than fear. It's the Christian, and it's the Muslim, and it is the Hindu, and it is the Jewish, and it is the secular humanist thing to do. The way for us to deal with our fear of the consequences of a Trump presidency, or a certain mayor's victory a few years ago, or a turn to extremism in any form, has to lie in our decision, to use Peter's words again, to refuse to let our tongues speak evil or our lips deceit, no matter what the demagogues like Gingrich and his ilk are screaming. We should not fear as they fear. Instead, we must redouble our efforts to create peace or shalom for the whole body politic. Now, I can't tell you what policies or strategies exactly will achieve these aspirational kind of goals for Canada. You know, if I were to tell you what policies we ought to follow, that would make me a liberal or a conservative or an NDP policy wonk instead of a preacher. But I'm a preacher. Still, the values that drive our policy choices, whatever they are, the values that drive our voting and our strategic decisions at our workplace should have roots in biblical passages such as the one we read today, or on the Sermon on the Mount, or the love chapter in 1 Corinthians 13, or Jesus' claim that what we do for the prisoner and the hungry and those poorly clothed is what we're actually doing for him. We don't have to put our fear in the driver's seat, but we could put our compassion for the poor who live at Jane and Finch, for the First Nations people who live in our prisons and on their reserves, for the homeless that we walk by at the subway entrances, for the immigrants who can't find work that fits their training and abilities. We could put our compassion in our political driver's seat and let that compassion drive our search for policy and our choice for whom we vote for. This, in fact, is what we've already done often as a church. We've done it through our support for a refugee family that is coming, or Kenny's First Nation project with at-risk youth, and many of this church's other social outreach programs. This is good stuff. This is a remarkable congregation. But besides charity, I really would like you to get this through your heads. I want to get it through mine. Besides charity, we also have real influence to do lasting social good on a far larger playing field. This is because most of us are well-educated. Many of us have careers that influence who buys, what they buy, what values our corporations will be run by. We do vote, unlike 48% of Americans. And not only do we vote, but many of us are at the table when we pick candidates. And we can have an influence on their policy. We actually know many of our political representatives personally. We hire people. We can take on pro bono clients. Some of us run nonprofits. Many of us have personal resources that can be invested in social good and charity and culture. We are, for the most part, if not entirely, we are utterly unlike the dispossessed who voted in large numbers for Trump, or the dispossessed on the fringes of Canadian society. We do not need to fear as they fear. Rather than cross our fingers and leave matters to God's inscrutable plan, we actually can do great things that make a difference for a lot of people. We can, with those on the margins, help build a more lasting, more compassionate, more forward-looking dominion. I still fear, in my own small way, what Trump may or may not do. But I'm focused on doing what I can do. It is like how Leonard Cohen put it, ring the bells that still can ring. We got a few of those bells. Forget your perfect offering. Sure, we can't do it all. We're not perfect. There is a crack in everything. But that's how the light gets in. We're not perfect. We don't have all the answers. We're not all powerful. There is a crack in everything. But we can do our part, which, if we're up to it and honest with ourselves, is not inconsiderable. We can do our part to let the light shine in for the sake of our neighbors and all Canadians. We should not fear as they fear. We should be like Christ. Amen.